are actually, you can grab them, they're on either side up in front here. I guess if you come in late, we can maybe just pass some back or that, or you can grab them afterwards. Just sort of put those up in the back. So it's the same notes on either side. And so it's the transparencies plus the, additionally, there's some little review of topology, just point set topology. I can't turn off the front lights now. So originally lights, none of the lights would work, and now the front lights can't be turned off. Now they're all off, I guess. So it's all or nothing. So they are broken. Yeah, we'll leave those on and then.
Did you hear a bandsaw running a little while ago?
Yeah.
Was it really bad?
No, it wasn't too bad. Okay, so we'll leave these. So the lights don't work, actually.
Oh, they don't.
Okay. So when you turn off this thing, then when you turn them on, then you can't turn off the front ones.
Okay.
So something's broken,
okay.
But yeah. Okay, so you could just pass those, yeah. There's some more there, too. Okay, so so like I said, the notes, and I'll make the notes available like Friday or that for this lecture. And just sort of starting, we had a couple little homework problems. We'll have two more today. So we had two last time just to talk about. And so here's one of the statements you know, to think about. So did anyone come up with a conclusion on this? Is this true or false? Can you prove or disprove? So if you're still thinking about it, maybe the thing is think about doing it in a disconnected case, and that might be sort of a little route to it. So once you find one example, so I'm sort of telling you it's actually, you can't really prove this. Once you find one example, you'll find an infinite number of other examples. Okay, so that's one of our little homeworks on some of the stuff. So let's jump ahead where we left off. We were talking about basic causal structure. The other thing is we had homework number two, which is finding the killing vectors for these following metrics. And some of this will come up in the actual talks probably towards the end today. So where we left off is we start talking about the causal diagrams. One reason I gave you the notes is as we talk about the structure, we can actually, causal structure, we can go through and apply the definitions. I just see this guy sort of jumped ahead here. Let me just go to the right point. And there we are. Okay. We'll just start it here. Okay. So we were doing these so-called Penrose diagrams. And just to review a little bit, is the first one we were thinking of was Minkowski space. And so what I've done here is I've drawn a diagram which sort of compactifies Minkowski space into some region you can actually see. And I want to point out some of the different aspects of this. And then you can think about our different definitions. We had the Cauchy slice, we had chronological past and future, we had causal past and future. So what we want to do is we also want to talk about black holes. And so at some point we want to get to that definition. And then we're going to see how particle production, and that's sort of where we're going. So this diagram here is the Penrose diagram, and what the Penrose diagram is you just are sort of pushing all the distances into finite distances. So it's like the stereographic projection of the two sphere that we had for the plane as one coordinate chart, but now you're doing this for the whole space-time. In this diagram, so this is just flat Minkowski space, we've suppressed two dimensions, if we think of this as 4D Minkowski space. And what scribe plus and scribe minus represent here is these are where the null geodesics, which are infinitely long, go out to. These geodesics here are actually the time-like geodesics. And so what I was saying at the end last time is if you think of yourself sitting in the desk listening to the lecture, what you're really thinking of is your world lines are just these straight lines, unless you're jumping around a lot. If you're pretty much just sitting there, it's a good approximation to say your world line is just a straight line parallel to the t-axis. But when you do this conformal completion, you're pushing things in, and so those straight lines get bent a bit. They actually curve. Same thing happens in the case of Schwarzschild and the other solutions, but we have to keep that in mind. Now, the advantage of doing this, this is a conformal transformation. We'll have a formal definition at the end of the examples, but the advantage is angles are preserved by conformal transformations, and the causal structure really only deals with angles. Is a curve time-like? Is it space-like? Or is it null? So the null curves will be preserved. In these diagrams, typically, our null curves are at 45 degrees. We've assumed the speed of light was 1. Now, here's some non-geodesic time-like curves. They can actually end and start on scribe minus and scribe plus. Scribe plus, in this diagram, we don't have its formal definition, is actually the future where all of the null geodesics go. And this is the past where they're coming from. And these are radial null geodesics, just meaning we haven't done anything in the angular coordinates. So each point along one of these, again, is just a two-dimensional sphere. Here's your point at infinity, spatial infinity. So first of all, you can ask, is this space-time is drawn this way? Is this globally hyperbolic, one of our definitions? And to be globally hyperbolic, what you want to ask yourself, is there a Cauchy slice? Is there some space-like hypersurface such that every geodesic passes through that a unique number of times, exactly once through the surface? And if you take your standard t equals 0 slice, in this diagram, it would start here and come in. We're writing this in radial coordinates. Another diagram, you could double this over and have a triangle, or you could be fancy and have a three-dimensional sort of cone for the top and a cone for the bottom where you've only suppressed one dimension. So this guy here, clearly, if we go across here, every causal curve has to pass through that surface once and only once. Okay, so this looks like it's globally hyperbolic. You can also ask things like, what's the chronological past of scribe plus? That would mean you take every point on here and then take a light cone backward. So once you have some Penrose diagrams, and in front of you, you can open to the page which has the definitions, you can start applying these and asking yourself which of the properties are exhibited in this space. What you'll find is this has a nice Cauchy slice, and everything sort of gets caught. If we trace causal curves back off here, they hit basically r equals 0. There's no missing regions. So this space-time is not going to have any horizons or black holes or anything in it. And we should expect nothing like that, since the claim is this is just Minkowski space. And this is just a description. Again, these radially directed photons travel at 45-degree angles. Okay, and that's from the diagram. What I'll do in the next lecture when we explicitly do Rindler, I'll ask you to try it tonight tomorrow before the next lecture, but we'll actually determine the causal structure explicitly. And what you'll find is when you do any of these, if they're spherically symmetric, you can always reduce it to a T and R calculation. So you just find the new coordinates, and once you sort of have the rough shape, you can figure out the compactification. These compactifications aren't going to be exactly unique. They're going to be some equivalence classes of these things. Now we can do our Schwarzschild metric. This is our classic black hole solution. And this will be one of our more complicated ones we do today. We'll actually extend it to other examples because we want to actually get onto the field theory and ask what happens when we do field theory on one of these guys. So here's the Schwarzschild metric. And typically, when you plug in r equal 2m here, you see it's singular. It's also singular at r equals, 0. But that's just maybe a coordinate singularity. And we don't really know. We have to really study that and see what happens. Now, typically, you think of the r equals 0 as really being a singularity because the curvature, Riemann curvature and scalars made of that actually blow up. And so you think of that as a singularity. But you still have to really check to be precise. What is a singularity? The other thing is that r equals 2m, curvature squared terms, so taking Riemann and squaring it so you get a scalar, those terms do not blow up. And so that's a good indication there's maybe no problem. It's just like spherical coordinates on Minkowski space. So it wasn't known in the 60s that these are black holes. If you actually have a copy of Feynman's notes on gravity, he called these things wormholes. He was a student of Wheeler. And sort of the whole, if you talk to any of the Wheeler students, Arthur Whiteman was a Wheeler student. You talk to Arthur Whiteman, and he also believed in wormholes and things. So there's this whole school of Wheeler students where they actually thought of these wormholes. So it wasn't black hole until the mid-60s where people started to really think of this with Kip Thorne as astrophysical applications. So we really want to analyze this guy. Now, one thing I want to remind you that's sometimes forgotten here is that for r greater than 2m, the metric's fine, but it's also good for r less than 2m. It's just that r equals 0 that you have the problem. So this metric, to extend it across, you have it in two different regions, and so the extension will take you across. So sometimes people reject it and say, well, it's only for r greater than 2m, but it's actually on both sides. The other behavior it has is if you go to the definition of killing vectors, what it'll mean is you can actually find these killing vectors. One of the killing vectors you have here is time. And that's for r greater than 2m. When r is less than 2m, these two terms reverse signs. And so it becomes a radial killing vector, no longer a time killing vector. And that indicates the difference in behavior. And so what's done here is you're writing some general Penrose diagram, which we want to get to in a moment. And so all I've done is it's recoordinatized, and we're going to push everything in and see what we get. Now, the other thing I'll warn you is when we do this, I really emphasize the notion of global manifold. You really need that. And so when I write this down, at first, if you just solve the equations, you're only solving these locally for some coordinates. And what you're doing when you do this, you try to find the largest coordinate set. Since you solved the differential equation, you didn't start with the manifold part. You need to extend this out as far as you want. The other way you can think of it, you can also start with a manifold and then try to find the metric. But typically, when you're solving things where they're nice and analytic like this, you start with the equation and push out. So when we do this, to do this diagram, we're trying to push out as far as we can and find the whole space. Now, here's the diagram you get after doing this. And it looks like little road construction signs there, warning signs. And those are the singularities in this diagram. So in the old coordinates, these yellow, black warning regions, this is your future singularity. And your past singularity is down at the bottom of the diagram. And those are r equals 0 points. So that's where you actually do have a singularity. This region here is r going out to infinity. There's spatial infinity. And you notice here, here's your scry plus, here's your scry minus. So again, you have these regions where the null G at Sx go off to. The other features you have is you still have this time-like, or your time-like G at Sx actually run off. And you could ask yourself, now is there a Cauchy slice here? And so if there's a Cauchy slice, that means there's a surface in this diagram such that every geodesic passes through it, every causal geodesic will pass through it once and only once. And so if we take this red surface, which is horizontal, that is the t equals 0 slice. And if you check that, every geodesic does pass through it exactly once. Now, a causal curve here will be something in the light cone. And you can just use this as your light cone, move it around, and it has to be either vertical or greater than 45 or equal to 45 measured off the horizontal. And so clearly everything works. Now that's a Cauchy slice, the red one. Each of the other red ones are actually time developments. If you take t equals 0 and you push it as an evolution problem, these are the other surfaces. Now you can ask, is there a partial Cauchy slice? The answer is there's a lot of partial Cauchy slices. Sort of one that comes up in sort of practical, like numerical applications, are trace constant slices. But we could also just think of those as our mass hyperboloid. We could repeat what we did in the first lecture for Minkowski space. We could take a trace constant surface, as they're called, or a mass hyperboloid. That would be something that would go in this way. It would be space-like, except it would start to go as a null surface when it gets out here. Now, if you check that, that's going to miss some of the points. So you can draw on surfaces like that and keep them space-like so it satisfies the space-like condition. But it won't be a Cauchy slice. So if you take anything that goes like this, like a hyperboloid, that'll be a partial Cauchy slice for Minkowski. There's also weirder examples. In the next, probably end of the next lecture, we'll talk a little bit about Euclidean field theory methods. And then it becomes important asking about global coordinates. You can actually get slices that come in here which are spatially flat. And all of the curvature stuffed, all the geometry stuffed into the rate of change of the metric. So it looks like a cosmological solution. Now those you usually don't talk about because they're not partial Cauchy, but they're still a piece of this space. And so if you're going to do field theory, the question is which surfaces do you want to really pick to do your field theory on? So this is like your canonical example. Now this also has a black hole in it because if you take the chronological past of Scribe Plus, you're going to run all causal curves back from here. And you notice they miss a big part of the space. Similarly, if you take the chronological future of these guys, you run everything back here, these would be things falling into the black hole, they catch this. And so you're missing this region out here and parts of this, depending which of those take. So there's regions of the space-time which are hidden from you. Okay. So that's one of the different features between this and Minkowski space. It also has this singularity, which we haven't really talked about. We'll sort of just mention that in the last lecture, how the singularities work a little more detail, and some of the ideas with field theory there. But it also has these singularities, and basically, the way you can think of a singularity, those are the points in which the geodesics terminate. If you look at your parameterization here, you have to think of the parameterization. These geodesics, this is infinite distance away, and what's going to happen if you run these hit this point in finite distance. And so they stop. You can't extend them any farther. That's why these are singularities. So in relativity, we don't really use blow-up conditions. We don't look at the blow-up of, does the curvature really blow up? It's sort of an indicator or a flag, you better be careful. But you can have singularities where the curvature doesn't blow up, and you can have blow-ups where they're not really singularities. And so singularities are where you can't extend your geodesics. Your observers can't, they stop in finite time. There's no way to extend them beyond that. And we'll see this in some of these instanton-type solutions, these Taub-Nut. Yeah?
What are the two different diamonds there?
What do they represent? So the one diamond, if we're sitting in the room here and we had a black hole, or you could even model a planet, then we would be sitting out in this region here near, it looks pretty flat here. So we'd be in this room where it's pretty much flat. And this region here, whatever matter or black hole would be over here. So this is a second asymptotically flat region. And so there's some question, this will actually be important for the field theory, is, well, how do we think of this region here? So when we started, we sort of had the black hole, we're observing it. So this is some second asymptotic region you get from extending the coordinates across. So if you actually take collapse of matter to form a black hole, you don't get this region here. And that'll be very relevant for the field theory, because the question is, what do you pick for your Cauchy slice if you're going to do the temperature or field theory of a black hole? Okay, so this region doesn't exist if you just think of taking dust in the room and letting it collapse into a black hole. But if we take that Schwarzschild solution, which was this guy here, and we actually extend it out maximally and do the diagram, then we do get this second region here.
So where's r equals 0? Is it,
R equals 0 is over here. It's the singularity. So what's happened is that r equals 0, you think of your traditional spherical coordinates as foliating it. And what happens, remember, is the r and t sort of flip roles when you cross, because the signature switches. And so this is r equals 2m across here, where you have your horizon, and this is the horizon to the past. And so it's that flipping of the coordinates that sort of reverses the roles. So the other thing you know is when you're in here, you no longer are static, so you're sort of forced to fall into the black hole once you cross. Okay? Yeah?
So if you have a metric that looks like it has a singularity, is there any straightforward way to figure it out?
I think you have to fight with the saw.
So if you have a metric that on the face of it looks like it has a singularity,
yes. Yeah. If you have a metric which looks like it's,
can you repeat this question?
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna do.
Okay.
Thanks for asking for everyone. Yeah. Unfortunately, you can see that the university doesn't consider teaching in the conferences number one priority. Okay. So what happens? So if you have a metric, somebody gives you a metric, it looks singular. That, how do you know? That's pretty much your yeah. And the answer is you really have to do some global analysis. Look at the geodesics. Look at their behavior. If you think of the example of the hyperboloid in Minkowski space, the mass hyperboloid, that thing is not singular at all. Okay, but if I do identifications on that surface, it then becomes singular because I can't extend it across. And if I start calculating things, that really is a collapsing universe or expanding universe that comes out. If the one we did would be a collapsing one, if you reverse the time there, you take the mass hyperboloid in the top, then that's a expanding universe, and that will be singular, and it really becomes singular once you do the identifications. So you really have to do the analysis to decide. And the other part, along with singularities, you usually associate black holes. We'll see in a minute that you have to know what's happening out here to know if you have a black hole or not. So those issues are actually sort of non-trivial. So usually if you have a blow-up of a curvature invariant, like any scalar curvature type invariant, so take the Riemann squared or combinations of those, if that blows up, then that's usually a good indicator. If you think of the case of the hyperboloid, that space-time is just Minkowski space. You don't immediately see that blow up, but you still can have sort of a crushing type singularity there. So you really have to analyze it. That's sort of the whole emphasis, and this will also be important for the field theory for same reasons. So this is like your canonical example. Now, you know, I keep telling you, you can only do these sort of nice spherically symmetric, but with this type of diagram, if you just think of this to draw how the causal curves behave, you can actually prove very general theorems by just studying these diagrams, and this is why they're useful tools. Okay, now, there's a couple other things which come up here. One of the things is the notion of outer trapped surface. There's always this talk of trapped surfaces. Now, this trapped surface is something which is actually in your space-like hypersurface. So what you do is you look at t equals 0, and you ask if you have a trapped surface or not. Yeah, question?
Why future singularity? The singularity isn't the time-like.
It's space-like.
Space-like.
Yeah. Because remember, the light cone still looks the same from the conformal. We preserve the angles. So the time-like direction is, time-like vectors point up, nuller, so it's a space-like singularity. Rydström-Norström, if we charge the black hole, then we'll get a time-like singularity there. Okay. And so when we look at this diagram, we could also look at a hypersurface here and ask what happens when we intersect the hypersurface with this horizon here, this surface where stuff sort of has this transition. This surface here is r equals 2m in our old coordinates. And that's where basically what's happening, if you look back at the original metric, the vector is flipping over, becomes null there, and then it goes as a space-like killing vector there. Okay. And so what we can do is we can talk about trapped surface. This also raises the issue of, there's air coming out of there. This also raises the issue of, so if we look at this, okay, so let's just go back here. So here's our time-like surface, and so this raises the issue, you know, can we determine something beforehand by looking at this? And this is also the question, you know, what's that other asymptotic region? So what I've done here, this is my t equals zero slice, and I've cut through, and so this will give me basically, you can think of coming in around the black hole, you have a bunch of spheres coming in. We're just doing this in two dimensions right now, or four dimensions, so these are really two spheres. You can do this in any dimension, but let's just do the four-dimensional one. So as you come in with these spheres, they're going around, and they're surrounding sort of what you think of as the black hole, but what's coming is you're coming in this way, and then they come back out again. So in the Professor Susskind's lecture on the de Sitter, he sort of mentioned this, how these spheres coming out in that with this second region here. And I've drawn this now. I've just flipped this vertical. So this is the one asymptotic region here. That's this region out here. So infinity is where this plane goes out. And, I want to go back. So infinity is where the plane goes out, and this is the other plane. And this is the intersection here. So this is what it looks like. Now, if you take a two-sphere on that surface and you put a light signal on it, what's going to happen is the light signal coming out here, it'd be like having a ball in the room surrounding the black hole. The light will just come out and shine at you. If we do the same thing, have outward light coming from this region, we send out an outward light signal, that's going to hit the black hole. It's going to go in this way. You cannot go from any point on this surface causally and get out here. So that means when you restrict this to the t equals zero slice, these rays converge inward. And this is what we call a trapped surface, because what it means is the light will start to focus down at a point. There's no way to get that stuff out. This is usually an indicator that you've got a black hole. So we could go back to the other question, and what you could ask is your metric singular or not? And what you could show, for example, is if you can calculate what you mean by this trapped surface, if you can do that for your particular choice of coordinates, you could stop at that point without having to do the whole space-time. Now, that's one little trick you could use. Just to tell you what this expansion is technically, I'm not going to go through in all the details, and then it'll be in the notes I give you. But what you're really doing is you're looking at a set of curves here, and you're looking at the, here's your light rays going out. So it's like a fluid flow, and these are the tangent vectors to that flow. So you think of a two-sphere sitting in the room, you send a bunch of light signals out, and those light signals go outward. So I've just drawn it as they're all nice parallel here. And then what you're measuring is you're measuring the rate of the expansion of just like it's a fluid. So the expansion would be, if you cut this with a sphere, it's how that sphere actually expands or contracts. That's the expansion. That quantity is exactly what you're measuring here. So as the sphere goes inward, here's R equals 2m. What's going to happen is that those spheres for these outward light signals are actually converging. And that indicates you're going to have a singularity somewhere in there. Now, unfortunately, you can make examples where you have a horizon, a black hole, and you don't have one of these trapped surfaces. But if you have a trapped surface, you know you then have a black hole or singular space-time. So it's not necessary and sufficient, but if you do have such a surface, then you do have a black hole. So it's just another indicator of a singularity. So let me give you one other example of a strange little space-time you can make. And we'll talk about this with the field theory, because you can ask about the thermal dynamics of it. So what you do is you look at that nice Penrose diagram you have. And the Penrose diagram has a lot of symmetry. We know it's spherically symmetric. But if you conveniently look, there's a reflection axis which passes right through the diagram. And what you can do is you can ask yourself, what happens if you identify this side to this side? Is that still a nice space-time? And you might ask yourself, exactly, what are you doing here? So we'll go back. So if you think of the t equals 0 slice, this is what it looks like in this big extended space-time. So if I reflect this to the other side, I'll identify each point here to the corresponding point down here because it's symmetrical. And the only points that don't get identified are the ones right on that waist of it. There's no corresponding point below it, and they just get identified across. So here's where I'll use my other little picture. I'll use this transparency, and I'll just make you the real-time picture of this to show you what this looks like. So when I identify across that line of symmetry, if I have the t equals 0 slice, that's the thing which looks like this. So again, each point here is going to the corresponding point down there. It's totally symmetric. The metric preserves the symmetry. But now at the waist, at r equals 2m, there's no corresponding point below that. You're on this two-dimensional sphere, and the identification now takes each point here to the corresponding point across there. So the equivalent diagram of doing that identification is you can take this surface here, and you can just leave it as it is and identify each point across on that two-dimensional sphere. And that's the corresponding diagram that you actually get. So you take this guy, cut it in half, don't do anything at the top, and just identify at the equator. And what you then have is you have a two-dimensional sphere with every opposite point. So x goes to minus x on that sphere is identified. The topology outside here is just the room's topology. When you get in there, there's these identifications. Now that's an isometry. That preserves the metric. It also is preserved in this Penrose diagram. Whoops, wrong way. There we go. So it's the same as mapping across here. So that's my evolution. So this is the new Penrose diagram you get. Yeah?
Why are the points across the sphere being identified?
Okay, so my rule is I'm going to reflect across the Penrose diagram. So I'm going to go... Sorry. Whoops. There. So I'm going to just reflect across here. Just glue across. Okay, and that means that the upper sheet, remember this is turned on its side. I guess it's a bias, you think of gravity sort of pulling it down, so you want to go into the hole, so I drew it that way. So it's in this diagram, it's sort of on its side, it's two planes. And so what I'm doing is each point here gets mapped to the corresponding point there. When I get to this point, all those points are just, you have to think of that extra dimension, they're just getting mapped to the opposite angle. So they're only on there are you doing the identifications. So you fold over this region, so everything has a nice map, but these points are sort of fixed. They just get rotated around. One of the features, I guess. Okay, so that's basically how the identification is going. The reason it's called RP3 geon is you can think of doing a surface here. You think of just doing a sphere. Just take it down to this dimension here. So take a 2-sphere. And now let x be basically the vector label of each point on the sphere. And my identification map will be x goes to minus x. It's just the parity. You just put minuses in front of everything. And the question is, how would I draw this as a space for the identifications? Well, every point in the upper hemisphere goes to a corresponding point down here. And so that means I can represent the upper hemisphere and bottom hemisphere by one hemisphere, just the top one. I choose one of them. And then the only thing different that happens is points on the equator here get mapped to points across. So in this diagram, this point goes to that point. So this is the same as taking a disk and twisting it around like this. So like in strings, if you do, this is this boundary here, I mean, or this construction is RP2. If you want to make your surface out of your Riemann surfaces, that's the same thing as the RP2 construction. Now, the only difference between my RP3 and that is I'm up one more dimension, so I have a 3-sphere with a point out, and so I call it RP3 because it's the same as this. So all that's... So all that's left is the equator then. And the only difference is this North Pole has been pulled out in my picture here to make it sort of go off to infinity. So this has some interesting behavior. Let's see if I get this to go right way. There. Okay. So what's happening here? So a couple of things happen. First of all, you got a black hole in your space-time. The metric is still nice and static at t equals 0. The map was actually an isometry there. Our Cauchy slice is still that t equals 0 slice. The Cauchy slice is actually RP3 minus a point, topologically. RP3, if you think of this construction, you'd have a 3-sphere with x goes to minus x. If you think of the 3-sphere, that's actually SU2. And so this is actually SO3. So it's a really nice orientable manifold. It's actually homogeneous. It's a Lie group. And what's happening here is you've got RP3 minus a point. Here's your point at infinity. You come in, and you get to this point, and you're doing this identification like this. So this becomes an RP2. It's a instead of a 2-sphere, it's now a non-orientable projective plane. But that projective plane is one-sided. It doesn't have two sides. It's like putting a Möbius strip in the room here. It's only one-sided because the space, being the rotation group, has to be orientable. And so this hypersurface, the mass of this space, first of all, you think of the metric there with the mass parameter, is the same mass as Schwarzschild. But it got rid of that trapped surface at r equals 2m. No longer has a trapped surface there. Its evolution, as soon as you push it, what happens? Well, if you just think of the static slice, these little Cauchy slices, there's always that RP2 sitting there. But if you start really evolving this, what's going to happen is you form a black hole horizon along here, and these become 2-spheres as soon as you push the hypersurface a bit. And the RP2 gets caught behind, you're never able to probe it, it's hidden. Because if you try to probe this point here, none of these curves go in, just the one from infinity can go back along that horizon. So this is a really peculiar example. If you start thinking about it, you can ask thermodynamic questions. What's the temperature of this guy? What's its entropy? It's a nice spherically symmetric space-time, but it's not one of your standard ones you usually see. And the other thing about it, its mass is totally produced from topology in this case. You never can take the mass to zero. In the Schwarzschild case, you can run the mass to zero and get Minkowski space. But in this guy, you can't get rid of that topology. So you're sort of stuck. The mass is produced by topology. So the reason it's called sort of a geon is this is sort of the old Wheeler idea where you produce masses and that from topological structures. Now, they never had an example like this. This example's only been known for about 10 years. And it gives you some other nice examples. But again, you can ask the field theory questions on here. What's the temperature of this black hole? Outside here, it turns out if you probe this, it looks just like the ordinary Schwarzschild black hole. So again, the global structure is very different, so how is that going to affect it? Okay, so this is another example of a black hole. So the causal structure, we've sort of gotten rid of that other diamond region in some sense, we folded in half. Yeah?
So the local symmetry remains with the killing vectors?
You still get the killing vectors, yeah. You lose a discrete symmetry. You lose the discrete symmetry that you identified across on there. We can do the same thing in De Sitter. And there, what you're doing is you're going from an SO4 symmetry to SO3 cross SO3. Because the parity map actually is killing, because you've already taken that one out. Yeah.
Exactly what happens to an involving analogy of this when it gets this dotted line that's RPG?
Well, so if you got a guy coming in here, it hits that, and that surface actually has no it has negative expansion, so that's a sort of a trapped surface, but it's not really a trapped surface because it's only one-sided. So, I mean, it's going to get caught inside here. It gets twisted up. Now, you can see the RP2 feature if you shine light off of here because you can send curves through here and bounce them off. But this is the white hole. This is the past singularity. And so you'd have to have, like, a light source out here. So there's... It has some very strange structure. We'll talk about this guy again with the field theory. And so you can think about this one because it's something a little extra. If you know a lot of the material already, you can think about this one because it has very different structure than what you standardly see in any of the literature. Any other questions on this guy? Yeah?
What does it become when mass becomes zero?
It's not allowed. You can't set the mass to zero because the mass is produced by topology. So in the case, it's not a limit you can actually take. Which brings about questions like what happens if you start radiating Hawking radiation off of the black hole? It probably has some, you don't know really, but you might expect there's some limit, some minimum mass you can have. There's some other weird features of these things. Yeah?
What about energy absorbs mass? Is that ever in danger?
As you drop mass, then it'll behave just like the usual Schwarzschild, so you can blow it up. So the mass is totally conform, you know, you can just scale it to be any value between, you know, zero and infinity. You just can't take it to zero.
Is the dashed line singularity?
The dashed line is, that's the evolution of that hypersurface. It's caught in, it falls into the, you know, it's going into the singularity. It's not singular itself in some sense.
Because it's also a place where geodesics end.
No, the geodesics, you have to remember there's a radial coordinate in here, so they don't really exactly end on this. It's just like the two-sphere itself in the original guy. You can send the geodesics out this way. So they end really here. You have to remember that this is r equals zero, so they're going to continue on after. It's this remark I made that we're sort of suppressing sort of too many dimensions. So you have to remember that's a radial coordinate, so it bounces off of there. You know, you can bounce it off that coordinate. Any other questions on this guy? Yeah?
The Einstein field equations, you still have to have a source.
No, no source. No, it's gone. That's why its mass is totally produced by topology. So, yeah, what he's referring to is usually when you do Schwarzschild, you think of the initial data as having a delta function source, and you've gotten rid of that. And it has a single asymptotic region. So it really is a geon in the sense of Wheeler. Yeah. And you can build other ones like this, but this one is nice because you can totally write it down because you've built it out of Schwarzschild. You can charge it, too. And if you do this in higher dimensions, you get the same thing, but depending on the dimension, if your space-time is odd-dimensional, the geon will become non-orientable. And that relates to the question, is the parity map orientation reversing or not? And so we have an even-dimensional space-time, so this is a nice Lie group, in fact, with a point out of it. So it has a lot of structure, so it's a, you know, nice symmetrical space. Yeah?
Is it possible to give this angular
It should be. If you drop, you can make the physical argument, drop something in. So to do, give it angular momentum, the quick answer is, yeah, there's examples with angular momentum, but to actually do it for something with nice symmetry, the thing you do is repeat the same procedure on Kerr. Or a rotating black hole. But you can abstractly prove there are solutions, but they may not have nice symmetry. But the way to do it with symmetry, I'd say, was just take Kerr, just like you do the charge case. You can do Reichner-Arkstrom. We'll mention that one when we do some more causal pictures in the last lecture. Yeah?
So what is the exact position of zero? is R two.
It's the geon is it's if you want to think about it as a position, it's sort of at 2m. It's where that RP2 is sitting where there used to be the 2 sphere in your original space time, and you've taken that surface, and it was in the original spherical coordinates. That was a coordinate singularity, but if you write this in Kruskal coordinates, the R equals 2m is okay there, and you can then just repeat the identification. The other way you can do it is you can go back to these pictures here and think of, you know, these guys and do the standard extension. One more down here, sorry. Where you think of this as the parabola of revolution, you can justify it that way too. Yeah?
So if the mass can't go to zero, what happens if you just let it pump in gradient?
That's exactly a good question. What happens? It has all sorts of other problems. So these are unanswered questions. I mean, you sort of know what its temperature and entropy are. That's been done. And after you see some of the field theory, you might debate that, since you have the question of how you pick the vacuum states. But the Hawking radiation question is very, very strange. And you can do some other examples where they have an effective fractional spin, if you do more elaborate things. And then they cannot radiate spin 2. They can only radiate spin 2 if they're going to radiate. And so they have to have some fermionic spin left, you know, so they have actually fermionic statistics. So again, the topological nature of it makes these things rather peculiar. And this is the one you can write down sort of in clean form. And, here's the... You know the global structure of it. So this is like the one you know best. Okay. Any other questions on this guy? Okay, so this is like a really weird example. We'll come back to the field theory of this guy. We went the wrong way. Okay, so let me just mention there's this Ray Schrödinger's equation. This is how this is tells you something about expansion. I'll leave this to the last lecture. We don't want to spend too much time on this. We're going to talk a little bit about the field theory. But this is what tells you how the expansion behaves, this expansion of this trapped surface. And this is like one of the most fundamental tools in doing anything with proving things about black holes or singularities. This represents the expansion. So again, you have in four dimensions, you're talking about basically a two-sphere or some other surface. You can usually, through some arguments, you can always reduce it to a two-sphere. So you have this two-sphere. And what you're looking at is this is the expansion of those upward-going null geodesics. So when you're on this other part of the throat over here, if you have outward-going null geodesics, they go like this. So clearly their lines are converging inward. So it means this derivative here, they're decreasing the area of that two-sphere. Then you look at this side, this has a definite sign on it. This is the space-time dimension, the minus sign. This has a definite sign, and this has a definite sign if you put an energy condition in. And this term is zero, typically, for these surfaces. And so this is the fundamental tool that you can prove the area always increases, the singularity theorems, and you can prove things, or topological censorship, things about these kinds of black holes and just general topological structures using this basic equation. This equation does not use the Einstein equations in any form other than just requiring this Ricci curvature be non-negative so that you get negative signs all the way across. And so all these basic things are actually proven for this. We'll come back to this and just talk a little bit when we do the area. We'll talk about how the area is related to the entropy. So we'll come back to this. But this is the basic tool. So when people talk about singularity theorems or that, you're only using this. So you never use the field equations. You use this plus all the causal structure stuff we talked about. So let me just skip ahead, give you a couple other examples, and then we'll talk about the field theory for a few minutes. Okay. Here's De Sitter. Our anti-De Sitter metric, and so this is the case with the negative cosmological constant. And then you can also have the De Sitter space-time. This is one slicing of it. And here's the causal picture for the anti-De Sitter space-time. And what you notice here is when you take this region where you have your null geodesics go out to what we usually call scry, it's one line. It's not bent anymore. And the other feature we have is it's no longer a null surface. It's actually time-like. So this has nicer features than the scry for the Schwarzschild case. That case came out to a 45-degree angle. So out at spatial infinity, which was a point there, it was not smooth. Here, this is a nice line, but you know, you've got spatial infinity sort of out here. And this is now a nice line. The only problem is this is not a Cauchy slice. You can have curves here which miss it. And so the usual maximally extended anti-de Sitter space is actually not globally hyperbolic. And again, these are your time-like curves, these are your null curves. So the same kind of analysis, you just re-coordinatize, push everything out. Now, this being time-like actually sort of behaves like a little space-time in itself. That is, if you look at the boundary, you can think of an evolution out there. The other behavior you have here is you can still prove theorems about black holes and singularities, and you can still prove things about topological structures, mainly that they're censored. Because even though this isn't globally hyperbolic, you can sort of extend your definition a bit to cover this case. It's not too bad. It's not too far from being globally hyperbolic, so it's not a real bad example. Here's the de Sitter diagram. Again, the scry, this behavior at infinity, is again very different than Schwarzschild. This guy is all the future going null geodesics, and this is the past. But notice, these are actually space-like hypersurfaces. So they're no longer null. So they have very different behavior. This actually causes problems when you start thinking about ADS-CFT type things, so DS-CFT, which was the case of the anti-de Sitter case. Here's some slicings of de Sitter. So de Sitter has a lot of different slicings. We heard about some of these on Monday's lecture by Professor Susskind. And you know, here's the traditional slicing, or this one here. We got our flat slicing. This is a flat metric times a scale factor. Here's a hyperbolic slicing. So what you do, just let me mention these guys over here. So you think of this tachyonic hyperboloid in higher dimensional Minkowski space. We get a darker pen that actually works. I guess these are all drying out. Okay. There we go. Maybe this thing is heating up so much it just evaporates all the... So there's our picture. And this is sitting in a higher dimensional Minkowski space. It's a constraint, so you're in five dimensions. It gives you four-dimensional space-time here. And so the different slicings here, the flat slices, you cut this with constant flat surfaces. You're cutting it this way. And you'll get things when you run this out, the surface cuts it in such a way that this opens out. So you actually get R3 for that slicing. The other slicing you have are hyperbolic slicings. Hyperbolic slicings are basically you cut them this way. You have to come in far enough that you get the surface. And you get a little surface here and there. Those are actually negatively curved spatial slices. There's another slicing which is less commonly known, and that's actually S2 cross R slicing. Now, you get your flat, your spherical, and your hyperbolic slice. Those come from just taking planes and cutting it with different types of planes. The static slice also comes from cutting it with a static plane. But this guy comes from taking what looks like a water trough, looks sort of like a Rindler space, accelerated rocket ship like this, and then in the X and Z directions, it's extended outward, or in the Y and Z directions. So in the T and X, it's an accelerated rocket, so it cuts through there, and the topology of that guy is an S2 cross R. So these are just a few of the slicings you can get. So this still has a lot of symmetry, and it looks like a cosmological model in its own right. So it's like a totally different, it's a Kasner type solution. So it's another type of slicing. And so the question is going to come, you know, when we do the field theory, well, which guy do we pick? It's going to be the relevant question. Here's the static slice. Let's see. Yeah, this is the static slicing in a Penrose diagram. And again, you see the behavior. You still have your scry plus, scry minus. And this shows you still have, if you go back to the diagram here, you have your Cauchy slice. And here you've got a partial Cauchy slice. And if you look, you still have the same Cauchy slice. So this is this. I mean, you can go look. You're missing basically this region of it. Now you can remember this is the standard slice when you just cut it with planes which are horizontal here. That gives you your three spheres which expand and contract. And so you have a three-sphere. It has a nice three-sphere metric. You can also identify points on this guy, just like we did in the Schwarzschild. And we can do an RP3 de Sitter, if you like. And the RP3 de Sitter still has the same partial Cauchy slice as the other guy. But now the topology of this thing, when you do the partial Cauchy slice in the static chart, you get an RP2 appearing for that horizon. So it's the same kind of story. You know, what's the temperature, the entropy, and so forth? And these are all questions you can ask. The other thing that happens if you try doing a Euclidean field theory on this guy, there's actually problems with it. The Euclidean sector is not actually a manifold, but you still can do the field theory. So we'll see how that works in our next lecture. Okay, here's a couple other things. Here's the, we already did this one, just written in different coordinates. Here's the hyperbolic slice of Minkowski space. Here's Rindler space. So for Rindler, that's the way to think of that. That's foliating Minkowski space with accelerated rocket ships. You relate the x-coordinate to the acceleration of the rocket ship, and the time direction is related to the proper time in the rocket ship. These are constant accelerated rocket ships. And this is sort of a nice set of coordinates. One of the homeworks at the end today will be to figure out the causal structure of this guy. This is like the, one of the easier ones to do, and which we'll show you when we do Schwarzschild. It's the same kind of stuff. It's very similar. This has very similar behavior. Whoops, that didn't quite fit on there. The Penrose compactification, let me shut that other guy off. Sort of. Okay, somehow it's just skewed to the side. But this Penrose compactification is just a general procedure which a lot of times in string theory is called the Penrose compactification. And the Penrose diagram is just a picture of that. And what it is you take your space-time. This is for asymptotically flat case, so this would be like Schwarzschild. And so you can go through and put, instead of asymptotically flat AF, you can say asymptotically anti-de Sitter, or asymptotically any sort of the other spaces if you're careful. And what you require is that your physical space, the M, sits in some larger space-time with a boundary attached. And you require that the conformal factor be non-negative, or in fact positive, and that the two metrics be conformal transformations of one another. And then your conformal factor goes to zero on this boundary, and its gradient doesn't vanish on the boundary. The non-vanishing of the gradient is what sets having a notion of some vectors, you know, time-like is a good definition of vector field and stuff. This is the formal definition of what we were doing in all these little diagrams. So we look for this compactification. We look for a bigger compact space that contains our other one with this rescaling. Okay. And our final definition, what we'll have, is black holes. And so a black hole is basically you take your space-time, and I call this just I plus, because this will work for anti-de Sitter, work for other space-time. So you take basically I plus here, this probably should be emphasized to be like a script, but this is that boundary. This is where the null geodesics go. So what you do is you take your space-time, then you go out to scribe plus, as we called it in the pictures, and you take all the causal curves that go back, and you remove those, and whatever's left is your black hole. And this is the definition of a black hole. So one of the things that is clear from this definition is you have to know the whole space-time to know if you have a black hole. If you don't know what globally your space-time is, just looking at coordinates and asking where they blow up or that will not tell you you have a black hole. This is a problem both in string theory and even in numerical relativity where people try to predict what LIGO will see. And that is, you have, if you try running a space-time on a computer, you have to run it so you get this boundary at infinity. So you have to have that global causal structure to really decide once and for all if you have a black hole. Because remember, those coordinate singularity, the R equals 2m singularity in Schwarzschild goes away when you go to Kruskal coordinates. It's no longer there. Okay, so now let's do a little bit of field theory. And we have about 8 minutes, I guess, with the interruption. I would say we'll end in about 8 minutes. Okay, so what do we do for field theory? Okay, so the field theory, we want to do field theory on this background. And so we're going to take just the naive, usual introductory approach. We write the field as a field which is an operator and obeys a set of canonical commutation relations, these equal time commutation relations. So this is the field at two different points, and they're at equal times. And then pi is the conjugate momentum coming from the Lagrangian. So this is just for a scalar field, massive scalar field. We can do massless also. And then what you do is you write it in terms of a set of modes. Okay? And you promote the Fourier coefficients. Now, I didn't call these exponentials like we would traditionally do if we did Rn field theory, a Minkowski space, if it's just on Minkowski, because we can use plane wave expansion or Fourier modes. But these are just a general set of modes which are functions of T and X. So you can think of those if we're doing strictly Minkowski, but I want to make us have the ability to just simply write this on this general space-time. So these are our modes. And to implement these these equal time commutation relations, we basically just require that A and A dagger be a set of operators. And so these U's are nothing more than our modes. And so these are our commutation relations then. We have K and K prime, where those are the wave numbers in the traditional point of view for our modes. And they obey these relations. If you obey these relations here, the phis are the equivalents of these, and then we have our conjugate momenta, and then this is the relation between the conjugate momentum and our coordinate variable. We define our vacuum, and our vacuum is this guy here. It's the one that when we act on with A, we get zero for all K. And so this is the traditional, every quantum mechanics textbook has this, like in the last chapter, and it's also reviewed in quantum field theory. And we have the additional property, if you want to do a one particle state, we just act on it with a dagger, our vacuum. So we can all do this. Now what happens if we do field theory in curved space? Here's our nice little picture. Well, there's regions of the space which we can't probe. And so a very naive argument, which people have come back and redone, is you can think of virtual pairs sitting here. And if the virtual pair gets close enough to the horizon, one guy goes this way and the other guy goes out that way, then one partner gets trapped, can't get out, and you then see a real particle. And this is Hawking's original argument. Frank Wilczek and collaborators have reworked this as a tunneling problem more recently. There's a set of papers. And so you can actually think of this heuristic thing as being precise. It's one way of thinking of particle production. So whenever you have a horizon or this forbidden, this non-probable, non-causal region behind the event horizon, you should be able to get this behavior. So what we want to do is go back and see how this is going to appear here. Okay. So that's sort of where we're heading. And so now we can define our field operators again like this. And the modes are not unique in curved space. I can pick a different set of U's and use those U's to actually construct another expansion of my field operator phi. In Minkowski space, they're sort of unique if you implement some set of theorems. Stone von Neumann theorem in particular, which tells you you have some unique representation of canonical commutation relations. But this should not be a surprise, because you even have non-uniqueness of the vacuum or ground state in quantum mechanics. Most textbooks will have some statement about the uniqueness of the vacuum for a scalar field, and even in quantum mechanical systems. But if you have some non-trivial topology, like you do a particle on a circle, the vacuum or the ground state, the energy eigenvalues or eigenfunctions don't have to be unique there. So usually the arguments of uniqueness in quantum mechanics sort of pre-assume you're on Rn. So it should not be a surprise when you do field theory that you should get some structure like this with the case of the fields. So what you do is you pick a new set of modes. And our new modes are just have bars on everything. Unfortunately, I forgot I dropped a K here. There's a K. These are Ks, right, because you're subbing over. These are your modes. And somehow I left it out there, too. So each guy here has a subscript K, because those are your Fourier modes. In particular, you could pick, in Minkowski space, you could just take e to the IKX type thing. Okay, so here's your new set of modes you've now picked. And you're summing over all these Ks. And, again, you're going to implement the A bar operator for your new A bars. They're the Fourier coefficients that have been promoted to operators. And the vacuum you now pick is the bar vacuum. And now you can write your new modes in terms of the old modes and vice versa because they're modes. They're a complete set of states. You can write everything in terms of these modes. And so I do that. And you get a set of coefficients or matrices here, infinite matrices, alpha and beta, which obey these relations. And this is called the Bogoliubov transformation. It maps one set into the other set. Okay? And let's see what happens. You can also write A bar and A in terms of the same set of coefficients. So all I've done to go between these, you can check the sort of matrix algebra yourself. All I've done is I've used the orthogonality of the U's and U bars, and I've used the completeness. So I'm assuming they're orthogonal, orthonormal, and complete, and so this is what allows me to do all this. And so I can do this. And what does this give you? Well, if the beta is not zero, you can check this for yourself, then if the A operator acts on my other vacuum, I get a non-zero answer.
How do you think this is positive and negative mode?
Pardon me?
How do you think this is positive and negative mode?
How do I positive and negative? I'm just having a complete set of states, and so I'm using the complex conjugation, the star operation for my modes. I have a Hermitian inner product. So I can write, abstractly, I can write the modes on this. I don't know what positive and negative frequencies mean.
I mean, if one set is complete, and then you are saying that you take the complex conjugate for that complete set again, or?
Yeah, I mean, I can take a set of modes and the complex conjugates of them. They're spanning the Hilbert space.
I'm just
writing the complete Fourier series for it. Okay, so I can. It's Hermitian. Okay, so I'm just writing out a complete set. So these are the modes, right? So I know what you're saying. You're worried about the positive and negative frequencies. So what I'm saying is we don't really know what that means yet. I'm just taking these operators, and you know, finding it. There's always a complete set like this. U star.
I mean, those
beta
coefficients, they come from the fact that mixing between the creation and annihilation operator.
That's right. Yeah, that's one way to think of it. In a moment, I'll tell you why when these are equivalent. But this is all. At this point, you don't know which is which. Okay, so here, if this is non-zero, what you go is back through the identities, and you find out this does not annihilate the bar vacuum. And the other thing you can check is you can actually check the number operator, which is A dagger A, and sandwich it this way. And so this guy will also be non-zero.
Why in flat space I get that to be zero always?
Why is this always zero for flat space?
Yeah.
You can prove that through this, there's a unique representation of the commutation relations. The other way to do it is you can do it in terms of the time-like killing vector, and then invoke, So we're not assuming we have a time-like. So these use, and that they're just arbitrary complete, they're complete sets. Okay, so here's the last, which answers sort of two of the things, is the time-like killing vector will imply you have a unique vacuum. That is, if there's a time-like killing vector here, and use is a set of positive frequency modes associated to that time-like killing vector. So if you have a time-like killing vector, that means the metric, for example, doesn't depend on that the coordinate along that vector field. And so that means that's a good parameter to use. And then you can define what you mean by positive frequency.
It has to be global.
It has to be global. Yeah. 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 Not just in the patch, it's everywhere. Yeah. Sorry? What if it's null killing vector? It sort of depends what you're doing. We'll come to that in some of the examples. And things will sort of, whether you have a conformal, a massless scalar field net, the answers will sort of depend on some of that also. Okay, so given another set of modes, W, I just called it WI and UI, then what happens is you can actually show this is, they have a unique common vacuum. And you can do that from using the fact you've split the frequencies. And so what that tells you then is that you need this time-like killing vector to get the unique vacuum. The other thing is this indicates you sort of have some notion of having a one-particle state. There's some non-vacuum. The two vacuums don't agree. And so this is produced by the fact you don't have this time-like killing vector. So it means when you pick different slicings, you will get different answers. And so here's two more suggested homeworks. Study the causal structure of the Rindler spacetime, work out the quantization for the scalar field. So by the causal structure, find the find out, you know, what the diagram looks like, you'll find out it looks very similar to the Schwarzschild guy. You'll get the two sort of diamond regions, and you'll get some other region which you don't coordinatize with the coordinates, basically the top and bottom. Because again, it's Minkowski space. It's not anything else but that. And then think about the quantization. So sort of how would you quantize the scalar field on this? We'll do this other part. We'll do this at the very beginning. We'll sort of write it down next time. Here's an interesting homework question you can think about. This is the question that I guess the periodicity on this is probably 5 years, I've noticed. When I was a student, I remember thinking about this, and I saw a paper on it, so I never did anything on it. And then I've seen it appear several times since then. Does a point charge radiate in a uniform gravitational field? And there's a really nice paper I'll give you the reference to at some point in the lectures. You can look at it yourself. And so what I mean is you think of the principle of equivalence. The accelerated charge has to be the same as the charge sitting in a uniform gravitational field. If you have accelerated charge in classical electromagnetism, you expect it to radiate. So if I have a charge sitting here, is it giving off radiation to the principle of equivalence? And so the answer is yes, no, it depends on which paper you read. And so it's there's a periodicity of 5 years or so where you see the other version of it, and then you usually see the correct. Interestingly enough, Feynman's original lectures on gravity from 1962 actually has this as a little problem. But unfortunately, if you buy the book that they sell, I think the answer is wrong. It's hard to read between the lines what they say, but it seems that the editor didn't quite get it right. Because it's not Feynman's answer, right? The book, it was an unfinished manuscript that after he passed away, people finished. And so fortunately, you know, there are some copies of the original notes which are about that thick, and then the book is about that thick. You know, so people went in, put more historical things, removed some of the things he talked about. So it's sort of an interesting thing. So this is something, you know, there's different answers. If you answer it, you know, think of it carefully, then there's like one answer. Okay, so this is a good place to stop. Thanks. Sorry?
I'm thinking about these different vacuums, which are distinct.
Right.
If you really do have different vacuums, then you expect some instant to start. So, and then the system, that has to do with the particle creation.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay, there's two ways you could have different vacuum. One is you can have the instanton thing, which is a non-unique vacuum itself, right? And that's what happens in the quantum mechanical case, like on the circle. So your vacuum is not unique there. This case, this is more of a slightly different problem. It's a boundary condition problem, almost, I would say. Because what you're doing is you're putting boundary conditions on your operators. And so it's like picking a different set of boundary conditions each time, because you're going to pick, when you pick that partial Cauchy slice, you're going to want to have predictability with the Green's function and the different operators and that. So when you pick that slice, it better have some nice causal. So you're going to pick different partial Cauchy slices. If you pick the same Cauchy slice, then everybody would agree. But if you start picking different ones. So you can also have the non-uniqueness caused by, that's really the case that I mentioned, alluded to with the quantum mechanics, where you have the circle, and then you get different windings, give you different eigenfunctions there. So they're sort of related, but this also has that stronger thing where it's sort of how you pick your domains for the operators to precisely define them. We'll sort of maybe relate some of that, make it a little clearer in the next lecture. It's not exactly the instanton tunneling, at least in that case. Yeah?
So if there is more than one vacuum, are they infinite
number? Or? How many different vacuum are there?
If there is no time vector, how many there are?
Yeah, what's going to happen for de Sitter is there's an infinite number of choices for the vacuum, as a good example.
But there are the space-time without the time-like vector, which is a finite number?
Usually what you expect, most of the calculations are only going to be when you can do the mode. So usually the space will be like a homogeneous space if you do a cosmological model, or have a lot of symmetry, again, even in the asymptotically flat. And you can produce infinite numbers of vacua. And so the burden of figuring out which one's the correct one is from the physical boundary conditions, is what does the physics tell you? And we'll talk about the Schwarzschild one, where if you think of it as a collapsing black hole, there's a very natural choice. But if you think of that Penrose diagram I drew, then you can see you're going to get infinite number of choices, because there's all these different ways of slicing the guy.
And then another question. Are these fields source for the Einstein tensor, or they are not source?
Yeah, so that's the whole industry of quantum fields in curved space-time was actually constructed to figure out what the expectation value of the stress energy tensor was. So you could put that in as a back reaction calculation. And now it's being used in string theory in a slightly different way in some cases. But that was a goal originally. And when you put the back reaction calculation, you can have some really pathological things. For example, there's a 20-year-old paper where Minkowski space becomes unstable if you do this. And so you have to be very careful if you use this as a source into a back reaction. And so one of the reference for this was the Perella and Davies book, which really is interested, if you've read that at all, is really interested in doing that vacuum expectation value. So a lot of the techniques there are really concentrating on that. You get the conformal anomalies and stuff. So the goal is to sort of feed this back in, but a lot of people don't believe that technique, you know, that's really the exactly correct thing to do any longer. But it's important to know this non-uniqueness of the vacuum and how it's sort of handled in particular cases. Yeah. Okay. Yes?
Some of these examples that you did with identifications looked like sort of orbital folding thing.
Yeah.
So in string theory, when you do this, you're allowed to do it because you have some extra stakes that allow you to preserve unitarity. But in QFT, wouldn't you lose these stakes? Because you wouldn't have winding stakes. So it seems that if you try to write QFT on some kind of orbital folding background.
Yeah, so one of the examples I'll do the de Sitter. And what happens, it's sort of a nice example, the RP3 de Sitter, because we can do the different vacuum for de Sitter. And so the natural thing is, when you do your modes, a natural set of modes is to take the ones before identification and take the ones that are invariant under the identification map, the parity invariant ones. That would be a good set of modes. And you can do the Lorentzian field theory calculation. But then you can...
Don't you lose unitarity when you do that projection?
No, it's okay, actually, in that case. You're still dealing with a homogeneous space. And so that's what's sort of saving you there. But the other thing that happens is you can then ask, what about these Wick rotations where you get your temperature and all? And the problem is, if you do the Wick rotation on that one, you don't get a manifold. However, it's a conifold, and you can actually do the field theory calculation on it, and it gives exactly the same answer that you got for the Lorentzian case. And so you have to extend your rotation idea. The idea of originally just doing, requiring it to be a Riemannian manifold just doesn't work in even to sitter there. And the same thing with the RP3 geon, which is harder to do. There's this question, you sort of have this lone point, which is this RP2, and they got these two spheres on the boundary. And so you have to handle that separately. Maybe one last question, yeah.
How do you define black hole in the anti-just?
Exactly the definition we had. So the black hole. So yeah, you have to extend it. So you take scry, you build it off. You can build a slight modification on there. I'll give you the modification next time. I'll mention. You can define black hole there, and sort of the thing that happens. Maybe as I clean up here, I'll just mention the thing that happens for anti de Sitter is the black holes have basically spherical topology. If you're doing 4D black holes, they're like S2s when you take their cuts. But in the anti de Sitter case, the topology of the black hole can be sort of arbitrary genus, and that comes from the boundary at infinity carrying the topology. So the boundaries at infinity actually determine the sort of topology. So there is a well-defined definition of black hole, and it's actually mathematically precise, and you can prove similar theorems than to the ones that you prove for short, you know, asymptotically flat black holes. Okay, it's because running over a little bit, if you have any other questions, we can chat later today or at break.
Okay, let's reconvene at 11:45 and let's speak again.